Oh, that's my Prime delivery.
What, already?
Only one thing can match the buzz of Prime's fast delivery, and that's the buzz of Prime's entertainment.
What are we watching?
Heads of State, that new action comedy with Idris Elba as the Prime Minister, John Cena as the President, and Priyanka Chopra Jonas as their only hope. Looks like a blast.
From fast delivery to explosive entertainment, it's on Prime. For only $8.99 a month, join now. Content includes limited ads, subscription auto-renews. For more information, go to amazon.co.uk/prime.
Hello, and thanks for listening. This is I Think You're Overthinking It, episode 1148. I just have a couple of things to mention, first of which being stand-up dates in August at Pottstown, Pennsylvania at Soul Joel's, August 15, 16. Also, Levity Live in Huntsville, Alabama, the following weekend, August 22nd and 23rd. We are more than halfway into the summer. I hope you're having a delightful summer wherever you are, wherever you listen. This episode of the podcast is Mr. Tony Hale, who actually his Instagram handle, I believe, is at Mr. Tony Hale. Tony is a brilliant actor who's been in literally some of the best things. He was in Arrested Development. He played Buster. He was on Veep. He was in Toy Story 4. He's in Inside Out 2. He co-hosts a podcast called The Extraordinarians, and also he has a movie coming out which looks fantastic. It's called Sketch, and you should definitely look up the trailer. It comes out August 6th. Tony is in the movie. He also is a producer on the film, and I do remember when I can't remember when I first met Tony, but I've known him for a long time. And he's just such a sweet, funny guy. We did a cartoon at Nickelodeon together called Sanjay and Craig, which I loved doing. And I think it's still out there. It's probably on an app or something somewhere, Sanjay and Craig. I played a loud snake named Craig. And he played a character called Nudeman, who I believe was our neighbor. So he was delightful, came on the podcast. We did not do this one in person. This was a Zoom podcast. I've been doing as many of them as I can in person lately, but Tony lives in Alabama. So it turns out I was not going to be in Alabama until August 22nd and 23rd in Huntsville at Levity Live. So we just did it via the Zooms. And we went pretty deep into overthinking on this one. And Tony had so much great insight and advice, and also has been a lifelong overthinker. So just a fantastic catch-up and conversation. This is I Think You're Overthinking It, episode 1148 with Tony Hale. Roll the thing. God, Tony Hale, what a trial for me to get all this stuff going. I was explaining to Tony before I started really recording that I was trying to get a three-year-old down for a nap, and that is basically just turned into like a rodeo because she thinks everything's really funny, and she's right.
Aww.
But I'd be curious to know how you guys sort of navigated that. You know, everything's a game. It's like, I've talked about this with Ben Schwartz, like everything's just like a yes and improv game.
Yeah.
So much fun because she's so fun and funny. But there are some times where there's some like parent business. It's like, now it's mealtime or no, now it's nap time or whatever. And you want to figure out like, how do I differentiate to a three-year-old? Like, like 90% of the time, game time. Now we really got to focus a little bit. How did you navigate that?
I mean, you've heard this before, but it's like those kind of schedules for our experience, maybe not other people, for our schedule, they were such a gift for the rest of her life. Like just having that structure, and she was a great sleeper, and she was, I don't know, she liked the structure of it. So it got to, I think around like three, that's a year in that period now. There's also, if I'm honest, it's hard to even remember, but I don't know. She kind of like, when she dropped her nap, I was bummed because that's when I napped or we napped. And then I don't know. I mean, I don't remember much wrestling to get her down. More like, all right, it's time to go to a nap. And she's like, no. And then we kind of slowly, maybe we'd play a game up in her bedroom or something.
Oh, that's clever. Get her in there and then
yeah.
Like, shut the lights off. She would be
sitting
down.
She'd be sitting in her bed and then we would kind of maybe play some kind of word game or something. I mean, I remember like laying on the floor when she was laying on her bed, you know, that kind of stuff.
I mean, it does seem like more and more we're just trying to, she's getting more and more clever. Like we're just constantly trying to have to like up our trickster game to try to convince her that, you know, that whatever we're doing is what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And that,
I will say like it, what never stopped, man, was I remember in the middle of the night going and putting my hand in front of her mouth, checking her breathing.
Oh my gosh. I'm so thankful to hear you say that because, you know, so we have the baby monitor, but the resolution's not amazing. And so you're always kind of looking like, are the sheets rising and falling?
Yeah.
And if you can't quite see, like constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very, I think it'll be refreshing for other parents who are like, is it weird that I check to make sure they're breathing in the middle of the night? And you know, logically, like, well, it's unlikely she's just going to stop breathing, but I still need to know as a parent, I need to know that she's okay.
And if I'm completely honest, there were times when she was a teenager, I would do that.
Just like, to make sure.
Just to make sure. There was just this part, because you know that middle of the night, around like 3 or 4 in the morning when the irrational becomes rational.
Yep.
And you start to have these thoughts that during the day you'd be like, well, that's a crazy thought. But at that time you're like, oh, this is going to happen. Someone's going to kidnap my daughter.
Yeah.
Those times I'll wake up and I've many, many, like just had the light just to make sure I kind of see her breathing or put my hand in front of her mouth.
Yeah. First of all, it's not crazy. And if you're saying this and we are also saying this, that means that a very non-zero number of other people do this. I mean, it's such a great jumping off point for you to mention the 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, wake up, you know, existential dread seems reality for a slightly overthinking themed podcast, because there must be, I know that there is neuroscience around it. My guess is that what happens is that your higher reasoning just is asleep at that hour. And so what you're left with are these emotions where you're coming out of a dream state where things just seem like, your brain's just like, oh good, you're up, here's 50 horrible catastrophes that could happen, and while you're working on that, I'm gonna create a fear pyramid of other things that could, you know, you could be thinking about at this hour. How have you learned to sort of back out of that?
Well, there's actually my friend. Oh, man, I'm going to get this wrong. My friend wrote this book. Her name is Laura Lee Farrer. And I think it's called The Hours of Prayer. OK, it's Praying the Hours, not Hours of Prayer. And it's based on there's actually a monastic prayer order that has been around for generations where there are different times of the day. There are different prayers during different times of the day. So like there's one called Prime. That's the beginning of the day and you're ready to go and stuff. And there's one like in the afternoon when maybe you get a little more somber and maybe a little more kind of down or depressed. And there's also one in the middle of the night when things kind of get a little scary and, you know, maybe the shadow, I think it maybe even says like the shadows lengthen.
Uh-huh.
And it shows like this has gone on for centuries where that time of the day can be a really intense time. So for me, it's kind of like, I do remind myself of that. This is not a unique thing for me. Like, yes, it's just 3 a.m. Of course, I'm going to be thinking that some alien is going to abduct my child in the middle of the night. You know, it's like, I'm believing it, but it's just kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I've got many kind of CB cognitive behavioral things that I do to myself. one of them being like, whenever I find myself in the what if, I say not now. I activate the 5 senses where it's like, what am I seeing, touching, smelling?
Oh, to be present.
to be kind of ground myself in where I am, because that narrative in my head just takes me to many, many different places.
I mean, I know that these types of cognitive behavioral, I guess they're not really anomalies, but these patterns,
yeah,
are pretty common. I think I would say they're a lot more commonplace, either because we're just in a period of time where there's more external stimuli than our brains have really evolved to handle, and so this is a lot more widespread, or we're just identifying it more now than we did. It's probably a combination of both, but
yeah,
particularly in our business, where yeah, I always say, like, look, the entertainment business attracts people who are sensitive to the external world, and mm-hmm, that allows them to sort of re-express those things through their work, through their characters. And it's not just specific to our business, but kind of creative stuff in general. But that also means we are sensitive.
Yeah.
So we're very sensitive to stresses and catastrophizing, yeah, and all these things. And even just in the few words where you're like, oh, my cognitive behavior, like, oh yeah, we're well within my lexicon. Like the Venn diagram of our lexicons are just like,
yeah,
right on top of each other right now.
We're also encouraged to activate those feelings. You know, we're encouraged to have our feelings right next to us all the time because we have to use them for our work.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, both of us have played very anxious characters at the conversion. And you can play that to an extent where you're not really making it believable. Maybe you can kind of showcase it. But after a while, it can get you riled up. And so you're using these feelings, and sometimes your body doesn't know the difference. You kind of go home and you are just wired, you know? So what other career is like, yeah,
just pretend to be this other thing for several hours a day, shut it on and off. And then somehow like take an emotional shower when you get home to just shake it all off. Like, how do you, and I do wonder if playing a character like Buster is because he's a little more of a cartoon character than some of the other stuff that it was. Yeah. Is it easier to play a character like that because he's so he was grounded, but also not at the same time.
I would lean into not.
Well, he had feelings and emotions and things that were important to him.
He had a lot of feelings. I don't know, because it's the same. You know, I always loved it. Buster, I remember asking Mitch Hurwitz years ago, what did Buster want in life? Which is a very actory question. And he said he wanted safety. And so Buster was always on the defense. So his posture was on the defense. He was always wondering what's going to come at him. So always in this heightened state. And yes, he was very cartoony and very broad. But like, I don't know, you still feel it. You know, I remember coming home from playing Buster and my wife said something and I was like, I responded very, like, very hypersensitively. And she was like, all right, let's just leave that at work, you know?
So you didn't make her call you, but you didn't do the actor thing of like, okay, while we're shooting, yeah, I'm Buster 100% of the time.
You'd be and
you
like, have to and here's assume... the divorce. Here's the divorce papers.
Oh, hello. I feel like his sort of, I feel like Buster's like little profile quote would be, oh, hello. It was just like, oh, hello. There's always to hear you describe him as defensive is really interesting because he sought safety. But also like, that's kind of what grounds him, because at the core of it, we're all a little Buster-y in that way. It's like, we're all a little defensive. We're all seeking safety. And so he was just sort of a very extreme expression of our kind of our inner child.
Yeah. And you know what's cool? I don't know if you've experienced this, but I was talking to my therapist. I was talking a while ago and he was saying, it's interesting how your work has kind of paralleled where you are in life. And I just moved to LA. I was very overwhelmed when I was doing Arrested Development. I felt like I was constantly absorbing it at the same time, just freaked out. And thankfully I was playing that kind of a character, but it's like, I don't know if I could have played a really confident character at that time in my life. And I've also dealt with a lot of anxiety in my life. I've dealt with a lot of, I was a very sensitive kid. I was bullied, all that kind of, you know, stuff. But it was cool how it's kind of used in my characters, but it also a little bit paralleled my life. I mean, obviously an extreme version of it, but at the time I was just kind of I was just very much heightened at that time.
And did you kind of have that classic thing of, because I feel like I did, and I wonder if a lot of people experience this, like if you struggle with a lot of anxiety growing up and you struggle with a lot of getting like pushed around when you were a kid and never really feeling like you fit in. And then you go, okay, I'm going to pursue this career on the creative side. It's very fulfilling. Then kind of on the business side, I think it's going to fix me. It's going to really, it's like all the ego stuff. Like it's really going to make, it's going to make all that shit go away and everyone can just fuck off. And then I find that you never really get to that, like that path.
No.
You open one door and it's like, oh, there's another fucking path. You know, like it's not, there's, you never really hit that goal. Did you find that? Did you have to find your grounding in other areas than the ego based ones?
Yeah. And I mean, when you're starting out, you don't think it's that. You're just like, I want to like really express myself. And I want to like all these excuses. And you're like, I wanted attention. I wanted to go back to my high school and be like, look what you made fun of. You know, I wanted the awards. I wanted to be on the talk shows. I didn't admit it, but I was 25 when I started out doing commercials and I had those stars in my eyes. And then I got my dream. I got the sitcom. And I'm thankful that it happened early on because when you have an experience where your dream didn't satisfy the way you thought it was going to satisfy you and the attention you got did not scratch the itch that you thought it was going to scratch, it was a huge wake-up call that I don't know if... I'm very thankful for that opportunity because it really freaked me out. When I see, and you know this, you've talked about this, I'm sure, but it's never enough. You get that attention and it's sugar. You just want more and more and more. There's a hole at the bottom of that well. And yeah, so when you get that early on, it's like, oh, I got to get my ass in therapy and start realizing that I'm not very present in my life.
Well, you're very lucky that that was the path you chose because that's where addiction can happen and just like way spinning out of control because it's like if the thing that you were so sure, this external thing was going to ground you doesn't, well, fuck, now what, you know? Yeah. And so I do kind of think it'd be interesting if there were, I'm sure there are, you know, like acting, performing classes that had a little bit of a psychological component, like, hey, by the way, just know doing these things will be creatively fulfilling. These other certain things are not necessary. If you're here to get fixed by some external thing, there's like, you still got to do the interior work. It's sort of like when you quit, you know, oh, fuck, I've been sober for 21 years now, but when you quit drinking, your problems don't automatically just get solved. It's just like, okay, well, that kind of shits out of the way so that I can begin. It's like now I can, with a clear head, start to figure out that stuff rather than just like one thing, just magically like, hey, I'm fixed. It's like, oh, well, you know, that's an ongoing process and it's you know, evolving.
And yeah, so, I actually, when I get the opportunity to talk to students who want to get into this business, I could give them tips on acting and I think it's fun, you know, but mainly I love talking about rejection. I love talking about identity, fame, you know, like the base of fame is everybody wants to be known and they look at fame as the ultimate being known.
Now everyone can be thanks to social media.
Yeah. But it's like honestly, if you're loved by people who you know and love, that's all the known you need because actually the more, quote, famous you get, you get less known because you wonder if there's strings attached. You take someone like, you know, the biggest star in the world, and then you take someone who works at the mall in Alabama or whatever. Anything that's said to the biggest star in the world, they're wondering, is there strings attached? What's their motivations? They got to question everything that someone has said to them. That person in the mall is not questioning it. They're just happily receiving it. So I would pitch that person's more known than the biggest star in the world.
It was interesting to hear you say that because it kind of makes me think like, you know, that biggest star in the world inside starts to become more Buster again. Because they're constantly on the defensive, probably because, you know, they've just sort of evolved that they had to be a little more on the defensive, but it is good to point out to people like, hey, I know it's difficult external things don't necessarily fix you in the way that you think they're going to. And that's helpful to know so that you don't have this really jarring wake up call when you're like, but I'm sure so many people have been like, I don't understand. I have this job that I love and this, and I don't feel fixed. Yeah. It's like, I know, but that's okay, because at least you're acknowledging that, and you can sort of figure, then you can begin to do the work to figure out.
Yeah.
It's like, we call it the hedonic, I think that online I've seen it called the hedonic hamster wheel, where just are constantly like, whatever level you get to, you go, I just want to get to this. Oh, you know, but up there, like, if I just keep going, oh, maybe if I do more, and then pretty soon that wheel just goes so fast, it just like flings you into a, you know, into the wall.
Well, I mean, and you brought up the thing of like, oh, I feel this. It's like, it's a lot of power given to feelings, you know? Sometimes those, I mean, like you take, yeah, they're welcome to the table. I remember doing, I mean, anyways, this, I'm going off on a tangent.
Please do.
It's the thing is with feelings, I don't think there's a lot of attention given to, hey, sometimes you're going to have a lot of different feelings. That doesn't mean you don't keep walking or you don't walk through the door. That's whatever. You know, it's, I remember I did this play 3 years ago in San Francisco and I was absolutely terrified. And every night this, you know, anxiety voice would be like, well, tonight might be that. Tonight's probably going to be like, you have a panic attack on stage. So get ready, you know? And this therapist would kind of tell me like, hey, rather than kind of try to psych yourself out, hey, why don't you turn to it and be like, hey, thanks for being here. I know you're trying to help. I'm going to go do the show, but I appreciate you being here, you know? And it's because the fact is, if I relied on my feelings at the time, I wouldn't do the show.
Right.
You know, if I relied on being in the perfect place of peace, the perfect place of confidence, I'd never do the show.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying feelings are wonderful, but sometimes they're not telling the truth.
Well, not only are they not telling the truth, but they have a very limited scope of understanding. So they are basically, it seems to me that they're always trying to, quote unquote, help you in any given moment, not feel discomfort. Yeah. You know what I mean? So if it's like, going to do that thing is going to be uncomfortable. And it is. You're going to do a live performance in front of people. Yeah. It can be scary, you know, like whatever. Yeah. And so its immediate kind of solution is like, well, just don't do that. And you might go, oh, I better listen to that. But like, you're absolutely right. The acknowledgement of the feeling sometimes is enough to dissipate it, or at least get you out of that spiral where you start catastrophe. It's like a fucking funnel web spider where you just get pulled into this catastrophizing until it eats your face. But every time
if you go against it, it's going to get bigger.
Right.
You know, but it's like, I never thought about, hey, why don't I try to have compassion for the feeling? Maybe that will either dissipate it or at least make it smaller.
Oh my gosh. You sound like someone who's been in two Inside Out movies.
I know, exactly. No, just one.
It's such a great distillation of how our minds work.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. And it's, I mean, the whole kind of bringing the, and to your point, I love it. Like, they really are trying, they're thinking their way is the best way to protect you.
Yeah.
You know? And so anxiety and Inside Two was like, no, this is, we have to create all these plans. You know, it's like the girl might be feeling this is the right way, but anxiety is, that's not the best choice, you know?
And it can also start creating all these patterns, and then it starts to dovetail into OCD behavior patterns because you are trying to, again, feel safe. So you're creating superstitions, rituals, things.
Yeah.
And I find that it really does, whichever side, it's like that old, like, you know, which wolf is more powerful? The one you feed, you know, like, and it's like, if you feed the anxiety, if you feed those ritualistic behavioral tendencies, they get stronger. When you acknowledge them and go, I hear you, but I'm going to take this other action, that becomes stronger. And it really does, like, incrementally help, you know, for anyone who's struggling with it. I just always want them to know, like, you can be okay. It does feel overwhelming, but you can also be okay.
And two things can exist at the same time.
Yeah.
Two of these feelings, not to plug this, but it just made me think of it. This movie that's coming out, I did, called Sketch,
which I'm very excited to see, by the way. The trailer looks amazing.
It is such, Seth Worley directed, it's such a fantastic movie. but I play a dad in it whose wife passed, and we kind of describe it as Jurassic Park meets an Inside Out, but his daughter is drawing these comically dark pictures. And he lives in the tension. This therapist tells his daughter, like, hey, I think that you draw them as the healthiest choice, you know, like rather than like everybody looking at her like, what a freak.
Right.
Like she's drawing them out and it's healthy choice. But as a dad, I can have two thoughts. I can go, oh, that's a healthy choice. And at the same time, like, are you going to grow up to be a serial killer?
Sure.
You know, it's like you have those fears. And at the same time, that tension is always there. And it's okay. We don't need to beat ourselves up about that, you know, especially for parents.
Absolutely. I think we've really become so afraid of discomfort that we really feel like we have to be one or the other. And those days when, you know, especially as a parent, when you know, like your child is struggling, but you're also struggling, you really just got to put that shit aside. And yeah. It is helpful when you get to the end of the day and then you realize like, oh, I really felt like I was struggling today. It was, you know, it was a challenging day, but we all got through it and we're still here and we're okay.
Yeah.
And I do feel like it is important to take the moment to acknowledge, like, I got through it. Like, it's fine. We're okay.
Yeah.
Because every time you do, I think it's just another little nugget of evidence. Like, when the next time, because that's the shitty thing about anxiety is like, you know, I remember having panic attacks when I first started getting them in college and going, oh, I know I've had these before, but this one, I might actually be having a heart attack this time. And it's like, and every time it was, and it tricked me so many times for so many years, you know?
And there was no language for it back then. I mean, when I had them in college, I did think I was having a heart attack. And I wouldn't even if it wasn't a heart attack, I was like, I do not want to go through that again. So it was more the anticipation of having it.
Yes.
Was like the worst. If you don't mind me asking, when you did get sober, there's such an onslaught of feelings when that happened.
Oh yeah.
And there really wasn't a language. I mean, 21 years ago, there was a better language than it was when we were in high school, but
yeah.
Was that tough to navigate that just onslaught of?
It's a good feeling? Question because you know, when I can only speak about this from the alcohol standpoint. I never did drugs, so it's just from alcohol. Yeah. But with alcohol, unfortunately, there's no better term. You are arresting your emotional development while it's happening, and so you're numbing yourself. So I think there's this idea, again, not being a doctor, but I think there's this general idea that whenever you really start drinking heavily, that's when you kind of stop developing emotionally, you know, you sort of put that on pause. And so when you stop, yes, you are. I remember like being very emotional, having very heightened emotions at that time, because I was really feeling them for the first time without numbing them.
Yeah.
And so but I think I had a very good support structure, which is, I think, very helpful for people, whether it's AA or whether it's a therapist or a group of friends. You know, I had other comedians, I had good therapists, I had, you know, very supportive. And so it's in those moments saying like, hey, is this normal? And then have someone go, oh, yeah. You're gonna feel a lot of things right now.
Yeah.
And it's just going to take a minute, but don't focus on, you know, don't focus on the length of time you think it might take. Don't focus on what emotions you're going to feel tomorrow. That, like, just get through it a day at a time really is helpful, because it's like, just get through it today and then worry about tomorrow. Yeah. Tomorrow, just live in this compartment, this day-tight compartment. And so that's kind of how I navigated it. But absolutely, I felt a lot of big emotions. And then I really came to, it was one of the things that kind of helped me stay sober, was appreciating even like bad things, good things, whatever. It's like, oh, wow, this feels like a lot, but I appreciate that I'm feeling it at all. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that I have the ability to feel it and get through it. And so that kind of, I developed an appreciation for it. And I think that kind of helped stay
the course. That's interesting, because that makes me think of something my therapist would say, rather than kind of looking at triggers in life, you know, that are just kind of like the bad guys. He's like, yeah, let's maybe starting to get a little trigger happy. Like, in these triggers can be little teachers. All these new emotions, you know, maybe they're just like, they're trying to tell you something. They're teachers rather than like, oh, here they come.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you know that you are sensitive to the world, especially if you kind of know, oh, this is a thing I do, you know, like it's, I'm not saying that this thing that's happening isn't real or, you know, or whatever, extreme or scary, whatever. But I also know that I have a tendency to be a little neurotic, be a little anxious, be a little OCD, you know, like all those things.
Yeah.
And even just the acknowledgement of that, you know, to your point of acknowledging the, you know, in the moment, the anxiety, but the sort of global acknowledgement of like, oh shit, this is a thing I do sometimes.
Yeah.
That kind of helps dissipate it too, because you recognize it as a separate thing. And back to the other thing you were saying, when you talk to young acting students, not attaching everything to your identity. The emotions you have are not who you are. The job you have is not who you are. You are you. Those are all external things that you can take or leave as you see fit.
Yeah. And there are days when you don't.
There are days, of course,
when I'm drowning. I'm drowning in insecurity and I'm drowning in jealousy and I'm drowning. Oh, it's just like, and you just feel like, golly, there are just large waves today, you know? And then you wake up the next day and they don't feel as large, you know?
And then you have to remember that they don't feel as large, because the next time they feel large, you go, oh, I can wake up tomorrow and it could not feel as large again. Yeah. And it'll be, you know, it'll be okay. It's not, it doesn't mean nothing. It also doesn't mean everything.
Yeah, it doesn't. And I will say, like, as a parent, it really was such a good practice of surrender and powerlessness, and you do your best. But she's at college now. My daughter just finished her freshman year. So, she's not in my house anymore. And I just have to, I mean, she's actually flying right now to go visit a friend. And don't think that I didn't think, oh, it just, I don't know, just the anxiety will kick in of just, she, you know, is she going to make her connection? And what's going to happen if she doesn't? And all this kind of stuff, you know, and I got a little, she's 19, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when you were 19, you were off doing stuff, and if your parent was like, "What are you doing?" You'd be like, "Fuck, leave me alone," you know. Like, exactly. I'm fine. You know, and you really do like that idea of surrender is like, yeah, I'm not saying it's easy, but you really do just have to just give it up, because there's really nothing you can, like, no amount of worrying is going to make it better. And I also think it's so easy to
say,
habituate worrying as a ritual, like, oh, well, if I worry, that's going to make this situation okay. And it's like, well, that doesn't really have anything to do with the situation. You're just attaching some obsessive thinking to a situation to feel like you have some control over it, but it's okay. It's okay to kind of release that, you know, it's okay to let it go.
And it's control based.
Of course it is.
Trying to control it by your worrying. And it is amazing how we know that their worrying is not going to do anything. It even says that in the Bible, you know, it's like worrying does not add to your life, but it's just like, there's just this part of me, like, I feel totally powerless. I don't know what to do. So worrying is my best tool. No, you're just hurting yourself. And I know all this in my head, but it just doesn't get to the heart many times.
No, of course, because, you know, you have these different sections of, you know, again, using Inside Out as the blueprint, we have these different sections of our brain that are fighting for fighting for control over, you know, who gets to drive the meat luggage that day.
Yeah.
And we're just these spaghetti sacks walking around.
Yeah, totally.
You know, being driven by, you know, whatever it is, our brains, our emotions, chemicals, microbes in our stomach. I don't know. But whatever it is, it every day there's something that's like sort of the dominating, like, oh, today's going to, I'm going to have this kind of day.
Yeah.
And have you been able to find a good pattern for kind of breaking out of that? But like, besides the acknowledgement, if you wake up and it's just like you feel like there's like the, you know, the ass of a cloud is just sitting on your fucking head, and have you just found ways to be like, I'm going to turn this around? Or for you, is it really just surrendering and be like, well,
yeah,
we'll see how it goes?
First of all, I just have to say, you're such a good wordsmith. You really are. Like, just the way you describe things is such poetry sometimes.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
How do I do that? I mean, there's there's so many different ways to answer that. One is many times it is nice having gone through it and like, this is going to pass. I mean, that's a very cliche thing to say, but like, this feels like the ass of the cloud is on me and it's going to pass, you know? And then hopefully it doesn't pass gas on my face. But then like, I remember this one time I was about to do Conan and you know how you stand at the curtain right before
oh,
you
yeah. walk? Yeah.
And I felt a panic attack coming on. This was years ago. And I thought, oh shit, I have a choice. I could either bolt, which is what I wanted to do, or I just started asking questions to the guys who were holding the curtain. And I was like, so where are you from? How long have you been doing this? Oh my gosh, they used to do a documentary back here about how people react. Just trying to get information out of them. And then the curtains opened and I went out. And it was just this immediate thought of like, I got to get my eyes off myself.
Yep.
You know, I've got to get into somebody else's life that, because right now I'm only living in my head.
Yeah.
And so there's, and I mean, having a kid has helped that many times. Like I remember the month Loy was born, Arrested Development got canceled and we bought a house that same month.
And you had a child.
Yeah. And we had a child. And I thought, oh crap. Like what's going to happen now? But I knew I got to keep this child alive. And she just became, and it had been, then after that, it was a while until I kind of had a really steady gig. But I just was focusing on her. Just, I got to focus on this little one, you know, and she was such a gift for that.
I really do appreciate that perspective because I felt the same way that it is a gift because it is definitely something, you know, parenthood for me has been getting me out of my head to just make sure that this, you know, this little beam of sunshine is happy and well taken care of. And also that she doesn't learn these patterns. I don't know how much is nature or nurture. I'm sure it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
You know, and even as much as we hide our neuroses, like kids are just these little, you know, like turbo antennas. So they pick up everything, but she, you know, but it's in as much as I can not be in my head so that she doesn't, you know, see that and start, you know, kind of habituating little adorable tiny neuroses, like just making sure that I'm the best version of myself that I can be for her so that she has the toolkits to be, you know, the best version of herself that she can be.
Yeah. And at the same time, your mistakes are going to be used in her life also.
Of course.
You know, like she's, you and I mean, I can only speak for myself. It wasn't, I had my, there was in my childhood was not the best things, but they made me who I am. And my daughter didn't have that, thankfully, but like she, I was also a nervous dad. I was probably a checked out dad many times out of anxiety. And, you know, she's going to become who she is because of those challenges, honestly.
I mean, one of the harder things, I wrote a bit in my stand-up about it, about how you basically save their lives like 1,000 times a day when they're toddlers, when they're learning to walk. Yeah. And sometimes they do fall. You can't prevent it every time. And then, I'm paraphrasing, Tony, it's much funnier live. But just the idea that they do fall sometimes. And when a toddler falls, they fall really hard.
And you
are advised to, like, don't freak out because it just conditions them to freak out.
But
of course, when it happens inside, you're like, Jesus fucking Christ, you know, and 9 times out of 10, they just hop up and they keep running. And you realize that part of what you're, even though as hard as it is, part of what you're allowing to happen is for them to learn resiliency and how to get up and keep going. Yeah. Obviously, if they need you, you're right there.
Sure, of course.
But rather than to freak them out before you even know.
Yeah.
The idea that they can pick themselves up and keep going and they're fine. And that teaches them that they have strength and that they can get up. I would never encourage a person to fall down on purpose, but if it happens and they can get back up and they can show themselves like, hey, I did it. That's a really valuable thing because of course my tendency is to want to be like, oh my God, are you okay? Let's, what do we need to do? How do we fix this? What do we do? Do you need to go to the emergency room? Are you okay? You didn't really fall that hard. Oh, okay. It's fine. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was, you know? And then you kind of go through all these things and then that teaches them a slightly different lesson.
Yeah. And at the same, yes, that is so true. And there's also that deep part of me that I don't want my, what you're saying, I don't want my daughter to face any challenges.
Never. Of course you don't.
I want, because that's, there's that whole snowplow parenting. It's like helicopter parenting. They call it snowplow, where you want to remove all the challenges in front of them. They just have an easy path, which is the worst thing for them, obviously, because that challenges are how you grow. But there's just that part in us that's like seeing them in pain or seeing them hurting or sad. And when my daughter goes through something and she's sad, it's just like, it's hard to watch.
Oh yeah. I heard someone said to me once, you're only as happy as your saddest child.
Yeah.
Which is like, whoa. But you're absolutely right. When they are upset, like if she's upset about something and her little lip curls, it's just like someone just put a dagger in lava and was like, blah, 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 like right in the gut. And you know, part of trying to not be like a codependent parent is to not take on what they're feeling, because it makes you less useful to them.
Yeah.
But oh my God, is it really hard not to just want to be like, I know, it's terrible. We can't find the toy dinosaur. I don't know where it is, you know? And trying to summon your own strength to be the person who's like, hey, yeah, this is upsetting. And sometimes you get upset and we lose things, but you know what? We're going to be okay. Or we'll find it. We'll do the best we can.
Yeah,
and ultimately it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay.
It is. And it's also so good that we don't follow our feelings, for me at least. I mean, there was a time, I'm not kidding, I remember thinking it would be so nice if I had a secret door from our bedroom to her bedroom that I could just check it during the night just to make sure she's there.
She's still there, still there. Breathing, still present.
Breathing and still there, because there's those thoughts of like, oh, well, someone's climbed through the window.
Right.
And taken her. You know, it's like, and I'm like, Tony, it's okay. You know, like, and then you wake up the next morning, you're like, God, what a crazy ass thought.
But I feel like it's, if you ever had hypochondria, it displaces and then all of a sudden becomes about, it's like, you're not necessarily saying to yourself like, oh, I have a rash there. That's weird. What if it's, you know, this weird thing on my arm, is that this or that, or, you know, the internet always says it's cancer, you know, or whatever. But then it just becomes like, oh, she's, you know, going here. Is she going to be okay? She's with you know, she's going to the playground. Is she going to fall? Oh, she's at school. Is everything fine? Oh, we're going to, where it just kind of displaces and you really do. It takes so much of your mental energy just be like, I just have to let this go. She has to be allowed. It's not going to do her any good if we're just like, let's just shore up the walls so that you never, and we'll just pad everything so that you never have to face, because you're right. They need those tool kits when they get older to know what they're capable of so that they can, because the world is not padded. The world is pointy and sharp.
Yeah. And also, if I'm really honest, is the question, when I'm worried about something happening to her, is the real question, am I worried I'm not going to be okay if that happens?
I mean, that's like master's level therapy of reflecting it back on you. And the answer is you probably feel like, well, no. But it's probably both. Like, not unlike those early panic attack fears of like, I shouldn't leave my house because if I have a panic attack in public, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so you basically, what you fear is dread.
Yeah.
Even more than the actual thing. You know what I mean? Like, if people are, you know, it's like, I used to be afraid of flying, but I'm not anymore. I actually really like it. But when I look back, I was like, oh, I was afraid of dread. Because heart disease takes way more people out, but I don't think about it because, you know, but the process of like something dreadful happening and the feelings that will bring is what scares me.
Yeah. And will I get through it?
Exactly. But, you know, like, you're here, I'm here, you've survived 100% of the things that you've been through. So, you know, it's always good to, even if you're not going through something, just remind yourself throughout the day just to kind of strengthen those muscles to let yourself know, like, hey, you're more capable than you think you are.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Amen.
When does Sketch come out?
August 6th.
August 6th.
Yeah. And it's so good. It's so good. It's Seth Worley. It was based on a situation that his sister had when she was growing up, where she was drawing kind of intense pictures as a child. And the therapist said to her, did you want these things to happen? And she was honest. She said, yes, because she was drawing about a bully. And the therapist said, well, I think it's really good that you drew it out rather than did it, acted on it. And so then these pictures come to life, and just, it's just such a beautiful film. It's funny. And I don't know, he just did an amazing job.
Did you produce it, or were you?
So it took us 8 years to get it made.
Oh my God.
8 years. And we started it. I mean, he had the idea, but you know, he would send me drafts and I would send back thoughts. And then it was a TV show at one point, and then it came in and out of producers and out of financing. One time we gave up, then we found the financing. I mean, it was just like a long process.
I would say television is a long process and film is double that. I mean, it's like to get, you know, especially now, I feel like it's tough to, you know, as all of the different companies are like, well, they're streaming, but then that streaming service doesn't exist anymore. It was only 6 months old, but they're pulling the plug and now it's all moving over to this other thing. It's just like not even knowing really who to pitch to anymore. I am always so forgiving of whatever I watch at any quality level, because I go, it's fucking hard to get things made. You watch some super low budget thing where it's like, the acting's not great and the effects are weird and they missed a couple shots, but God damn it, they made a thing. That's more than I did. You know what I mean? Like, I got a hats off.
Yeah. And they really, and when they're just, I would think, I mean, when you're doing something like that, you got to like really believe in it, because you got to have that string that keeps you going. Cause it's so, I mean, just like our business, there's so many times you just want to be like, let's forget it.
I had a run. It's done. We're good.
It's like we're signing up, at least as an actor, for rejection. Like, it's a life of people just saying you're not right.
And somehow not personalizing that, not applying that to your value.
How do you do that?
I don't know.
Because I've never mastered that. You know, I've been told that thousand, Tony, it's business, business. It's like, yeah, but my body is still reacting to the fact that somebody's telling me they don't want me. That's hard. Feels. I'm a feeler.
Yeah, know? Of course. Yeah, it is. I don't know if I have amazing advice for that other than just like, you know, well, you just, and maybe again, it's just like facing it head on instead of trying to not feel it. It's just like, yeah, it's going to be disappointing, but you know, I'll live. I'll get through it. It's just every time I do, I'll get through it a little bit better the next time. Some days it'll be harder and some days it'll be easier, but it's all going to net out fine.
And there's another thing of that, of kind of like the older I've gotten, I've realized for me not to get a job, they're doing me a favor, because that wasn't supposed to have that job.
Right.
You know, and you definitely don't want to be in a space that you're not supposed to be in, even though initially you're like, this is perfect. wasn't supposed to be your job.
Yeah. You know? And so sometimes I will take it to the extreme where I'll go, oh, well, if I had gotten that job, maybe a chunk of a satellite would have fallen out of the sky and landed on me on the way. You know what I mean? It's like I do this kind of fantastical
satellite.
Just like a chunk, you know, just like a piece of a solar panel, just like split me in half when I was on my way to that job. So maybe it's better off this way, you know, maybe it's fine. And I know how ridiculous that is, but it also, it just kind of pulls me out of it a little bit and like, it's fine. I'll be fine. Yeah.
I do that often where I'm like, I'll be thinking about something. I'm like, we're all going to die. We're all going to die. And I'm giving, and I'll think like, 50 years ago, people thought they were the shit too. They're dead.
By the way, I would call that optimistic nihilism.
Oh yeah.
Where it's like, you're putting a positive spin on that kind of nihilistic thing. It wasn't, you know, I mean, I guess it's foundationally kind of stoic, where you're like, well, it's all temporary. You know, like all of the emperors of Rome, one generation away, no one fucking remembered, you know.
No one remembers. And also, I was there for a long period of time for a job. The statues, the just luxury, the opulence was insane. It's pretty much just just like ego statues after one after the next. Yeah. Dead.
It's like this is basically, we're just doing that, the beginning of a Dead Poet Society, where he takes them into the hallway and he's like, carpe diem. And he's like, they're looking at all of the school pictures of all the, like, from decades ago, you know,
I need to see that again. I will say what I do like about that. And I can honestly admit, I actually love graveyards for this reason. I love being sometimes going to a graveyard, because it's a wake up of like, this is very fleeting.
And life is precious.
Life is precious, and it wakes me up to like being present, you know, just like, you know, let's be in this day.
Yeah, I do feel like I get a little overloaded with that, with stoicism sometimes, where it's like, I know I'm going to die. I know. I don't know if I necessarily need to be reminded every day, but I do. I do understand from a bird's eye view that is what happens. It doesn't scare me or freak me out. You know, it really never did. I guess it's just more that some days I'm like, I don't need to be. I know, you know, like that's not necessarily going to motivate me into better, you know, it's like carpeing the diem. But you're right. I mean, that idea is that we can kind of choose to make, you know, more or less whatever we want of the day. We do have that. Mm-hmm. In most cases, we do have that. But obviously, extreme things happen. I don't want to discount from that. But more or less, we do have the opportunity each day to be like, rather than be dragged around by the day, like, well, what kind of day am I going to choose? Do I want to choose to have? And how do I want to navigate these things?
Yeah. Yeah. That's always challenging. I have learned about myself. I mean, back to kind of like overthinking and all that stuff. I've learned about myself that I need structure. I need structure for the day, because if I don't, that overthinking kind of takes over, or just kind of like wasting time. So like having things on the calendar help me navigate to be more productive.
Yeah, I'm going to probably use this metaphor a lot throughout this podcast, but I used it with Ben Schwartz a few weeks back. But just, I sometimes think of my brain as a working dog, like a ranch dog. Yeah. Is that you can't just put them in an apartment with nothing to do. They'll go nuts, because it's like there's a structure. You know what I mean? Like they just need, like my brain just needs tasks in a structured way, because otherwise it doesn't really know what to do. And having a kid really helped a lot of that, because it's like, well, I have a structure because she has a structure. Because she responds well to structure. Not every kid's different, but she responds well to structure. Ergo, I am responding well, kind of wrapping around what her structure is.
Yeah.
So how was that for you, being is it called an empty nester parent? You know, like when your daughter finally left and you're like, oh, it's quiet. What do we do? Yeah. It was loud for 18 years. And now what?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause she graduated last May. She's just finished her freshman year. And we've had a lot of transition this year. Well, for 21 years, we were in LA. We went back and forth to visiting home on the East Coast in Alabama. And we just realized once she went to college, we needed to be closer to home. So we moved to Birmingham, Alabama.
Amazing.
And you know, that's a lot of transition, and it's, if I'm honest, you know, we love emptiness, and my wife and I have a great time together. Like we're best friends, and she's wonderful to be around, and we I love her to death, but there's been a big identity check. You know, I'm not reminded daily that I'm a father, but my daughter in that role, and I'm out of my comfort zone and who I am. Who am I? I'm in a city, which is a great city, but I'm not surrounded by the entertainment industry like I was in LA.
That's healthy.
Yeah.
That's healthier. I will say that I think that's healthier, because we moved out from the entertainment business too. Mm. And it just feels more peaceful, because we're not as tempted every day to be like, fuck, I'm not making anything today. What do we do? I'm not supposed to say, oh my God, I don't have any meetings. What do we, you know, it's like, we're just kind of surrounded by nature. Have you found that that's helped your peace?
I have. And I've also learned, because before LA, we were in New York, and I think urban centers, you're kind of in a bit of a heightened state. You know, you're kind of, you need to go outside. You don't know what you're going to see on the street. Sometimes like you're going to these things, there's kind of heightened experiences. So your nervous system is kind of always kind of ready. You're on alert a little bit. And so when in an arena like down here, that's a little more kind of every day and low key. I don't know if my nervous system is adjusted yet. You know, I'm still kind of like, it's waiting for the heightened thing. Like, oh, like what's around the corner? But I don't want it to be that way. I want it to wear every day and the simple become, that's the power. It's not these heightened experiences coming at you, you know?
Oh yeah. It's like, you really, it's funny when you're young, you see some old guy like whittling a pipe on a porch. You're like, God, what the fuck happened to that? You know, like, why is that? And you start to get older. You're like, oh my God, I get it. Because you're just focused on that one thing. You're doing something IRL. You're peaceful. You know, to me, like, happiness used to be about, it was sort of chasing it like a drug, I guess. Like, it's a thing. It's a separate thing. And it's like, now I think it's the absence of feeling stressed, hypervigilant. It's just peace. I guess to me, it's just like, oh, it's just nice. It's just happiness is like a, there's like a peacefulness element. When before it used to be like a heightened emotional, like a heightened, you know.
Like those were the goals. Those were the goals, to have those mountaintop experiences.
Yes.
It's still fun, like really fun. But it's like the power of the ordinary, I think, has been missed a lot in my life. I
love that. You got to write a book on the power of the ordinary. I mean, that already that's a New York Times bestseller by Tony Hale, and it hasn't even written yet.
I need that mountaintop. Okay.
which ironically like drags you back into the hamster wheel, and then you're like.
But I will say, I remember that made me think of, I was on a plane recently, and you know, everybody had their devices and, you know, we're ready to go. And there's this woman, she was probably in her, you know, 70s, maybe, yes, probably 70s. It was about a 3 or 4 hour flight. She just sat there the entire time with her hands on her lap and wasn't watching anything and just sat there.
Did you check to see if she was breathing? Are you okay? Is she okay?
Knowing my personality, I probably would have. But like, and then got up and I was like, man, what a... And to your point of like, that's the whittling of the pipe. She was just so fine doing that. And I'm like, man, what a goal. What a goal.
It does feel insurmountable sometimes with this, you know, quote unquote, connected as we are at all times. But I do think that it would very quickly dissipate. I don't think, I'm sure the transition from going from device, you know, information overload heavy to none of it would be a little rocky, to say the least, for a short period of time. But then I do think you would readjust fairly quickly. I mean, I see on Reddit all the time, like, you know, people going, I mean, it's kind of funny because, of course, they're saying I quit social media, but, you know, but they're on Reddit. But anyway, but the idea being that in not too long a period of time, people are like, oh, I didn't really miss it the way I thought I would. It's not as... You know, especially in our business, I think we're all tricked into thinking like, well, you got to be, why are you not, you have to post, you got to do this, you got to be, if you want to be a part of the bit, how many followers do you want to get this movie made? How many followers do you have? You want to get cast in this? What's your social media footprint? And so we're just tricked into thinking like, oh, in order to have value for this thing, I have to take part in all these things at the expense of my, you know, peace and mental health, whatever. But just the idea that, you don't have to. And sooner or later, you might start asking those quality of life questions that we're asking.
Yeah. I mean, and I sound old saying this, but you and I had years where we didn't have that.
Yeah.
You know, and this,
we were very much adults by the time that shit came around. Cause we're like a year apart, I think.
Yeah. And that this next generation doesn't have those years, or not many of those years, at least, where they didn't have that. And I do, I mean, I don't want to sound like Mr. Old Guy, but I do worry. I don't know what that looks like for the future. You know,
I keep just kicking it down the field. Like maybe social media will, you know, like maybe my daughter's generation will think it's so profoundly uncool because the older generations were so absorbed in it that they'll be like, it's not cool. You know, it's cool to whittle a pipe.
And that pendulum will probably go the exact opposite. You know, so, I mean, now they have those phones. Have you heard about those? They're like, I forget what they're called, where you can't text. You can't, or maybe you can text, but you can't go on social media. Just
landlines.
What is it?
Landlines. Landline.
But it's like you have you can get a map.
Like a flip phone. Text.
Yeah. It's like a flip phone, but I think it's like a cool, there's a name. It looks maybe like an iPhone or something, but you can't do anything on it.
Yeah. I see devices like that sometimes. pop up in my Instagram feed because I'm on social media. But it's those like, it's like the machine that's like, oh, it's just a word processor. So you can just write without being distracted or a phone that you can, you know, just make calls on. And I do see the, by the way, the irony is not lost on me that I'm saying all these things, but of course I'm, I post, you know,
I do check
social media. Like we
let people know about work and all that stuff on there.
Because you want to take every swing you can, especially when you have produced something and worked on something that you care about. You want people to see it.
And, you know, I mean, this makes me think of, okay, I've had a history of anxiety, right? And now I enjoy, I've learned a lot and I like to talk about it. I like to, the tools that I kind of got past it. And I think maybe this next generation, since they've experienced it, they're going to be the best experts to find a way to healthier way out of it. You know, it's like, who knows?
That would be the hope, you know, as long as, you know, just like, please don't get more insidious social media infused with some sort of AI that, you know, gets inside, you know, like makes everyone go batshit. But maybe she'll be totally immune to that because she'll just know innately what it is because she grew up with it. Whereas you and I, being the Gen Xers that we are, we, to us, it's not innate to our experience. It's something that we adopted later in life.
Yeah.
So we see it as this separate thing that we had to study and learn, you know, but they just sort of grew up with it the same way that they grew up with language.
So. I have to tell you this. I don't know why I just thought about this. Maybe it's because we were talking about our history, but I just learned that you were on Singled Out.
Oh, that's so funny.
And so I saw, I don't know if you, speaking of social media, I don't know if you posted it or what, but
I did. I posted it because it was the 30th anniversary of Singled Out.
Right. Exactly. So I remember Jenny.
Yeah.
But I saw that and I was like, you are kidding me.
I mean, who's going to remember the floppy haired dude, like average looking guy with baggy pants?
Association of that. I mean, I've known you for many other things. But like did not connect the dots. It was wild for me.
This could be a weird Mandela effect where there was, I did not host the Singled Out in your time stream.
Maybe. Oh, was there another host?
No, but well, there were two. There was Jenny left and then Carmen Electra took over. But I just mean that there was no, it was a different dude or there was no dude. Like in your time stream, maybe I just didn't exist. And
because I remember Jenny. I remember Jenny. I don't know if I watched Carmen, but I remember Jenny. And I remember another guy, but I just never put the pieces together that was you. And I've known you for years. I've literally known you for years. We did a cartoon together. We've run into each other.
I love that cartoon, by the way. First of all, I think that's hilarious, and I totally understand and appreciate it. And secondly, the cartoon you're referring to is Sanjay and Craig, which was a show that I loved being on.
It was fun.
And I still, so we're on a farm now. My wife planted 35 blueberry bushes and I call them bluebies because of your character Nudeman from Sanjay and Craig. It like the cast of that was, it was you and me and Linda Cardellini and Matt Jones. I mean, it was just like.
That's right. Linda Cardellini was on it.
Yes.
That.
And Malik Panchuli. And like, it was just such a phenomenal. And the music, the guy who did all those super catchy songs, a guy named Matt Mahaffey, and I found him years later. I was like, hey, I just wanted to tell you there are still songs from that show that are stuck in my head because they were so fun and catchy.
And it was,
we did a whole like Snoop Dogg rap. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Like a street dog. Like it was, that show was so much fun.
It was. And I remember going to Nickelodeon and taping it. And that was kind of like a big playground when you're in that office.
Oh, yeah.
But you're right. It was. And I think it did well. Like people,
it did great. It was on for like, you know, four or five. It kind of, it did the max number of seasons it could do before it become like, before it becomes a legacy show like SpongeBob or Dora or, you know, it's like,
We did,
I don't know, it was like three or four or five seasons or something. It was like sort of, that was the upper echelon of like what a show can do on Nickelodeon before they really like double and triple down on it. And my guess is that it, you know, like at that point it becomes largely I imagine like a merch business because then they just start putting the characters on everything.
And they just recycle it since kids get older. And it's just new kids. So it's just new kids watching the same ones.
They don't mind watching. I as we both know as parents from experience, the kids don't mind watching the same episodes over and over.
Yeah, and that's over. One of the reasons, actually, not to plug again, but why was a big motivation with Sketch is we wanted that kind of both parents and kids viewing, like, want, not mind watching it again. Like, those four quadrant kind of Amblin movies that were just like Goonies, for instance.
So you can watch this with your kids.
Oh, yeah. You can totally watch it with your kids. And it's just a really fun movie. But I mean, back to Sanjay, that was just a fun, funny show. You know, it was, but I will say, when Loy was little, and I loved Dora the Explorer, but after a while, you're like, I cannot watch another.
Listen, I don't think any parent's going to be upset hearing that when you've watched something for the millionth time, right, that we, like, we, one thing that we've had to do in the car kind of recently, although this has gone away a little bit, but she's obsessed with a show called Unicorn Academy on Netflix. And the theme song is just this kind of, you know, like a pretty standard pop song, yeah, follow your heart. Yeah. And so it just, that playing on a loop in the car. And if it stops, she'll be like, follow your heart. We're like, okay. And then I'll start singing like, follow your heart. And then she's like, no, Dad, the song is right here. In other words, it's playing. You don't need to, she'll literally say, stop singing. I know.
Will you just see her bopping in the back?
She bops to it a little bit, but also it's just, she kind of just likes it in the background. It's like, you don't think she's noticing it until you turn it off. And it's like, put it back. And then you're like, oh, right. Sorry. I thought we had all heard this 30 times, but please let's all, you know, and you just kind of, you just
womb, same sound over and over and over.
So yours was Dora and ours is Unicorn Academy. Perfectly charming show, you know? Sure,
of course.
I just, out of sheer ability to, like, just to try to deal with hearing it over and over again, I was like, well, I have to record a version of this song that's the most opposite. So I recorded this like 90s indie version of it. Just good. Guitar. I don't know if I'll ever put it out, but for me, it was just my way of kind of processing it. It was just like, I'm going to record like this, you know, indie rock version of it just to see what comes out. And it was really stupid and silly. Do you do anything like that? Is there anything you do just for you that you're like, maybe I'll never put this out because it's just for me? Or is everything you work on, is your intention to like put it out into the world? Do you have anything for you?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I make these, I haven't done it in a while, but during COVID I made rope bowls.
It's awesome. Will and you I'm please send me you a rope bowl?
Yeah, I'm going to show you one of them. And so a friend of mine gave me one on this job I was doing, and I just kind of got really obsessive about it. Here, wait, let me make sure I'm in the camera. Show Sophia. So this is that's what they look like.
Oh my God. That is not at all what I expected. I expected like that you just coil the lasso around like a basket. That's fucking art.
And so I paint the rope and then I sew it. And then I do a little leather tag with like an embossed. And I just, it's really, and I want to get back to it because I haven't, and with the move and everything, I haven't really done it much. But I just loved it. And I was on this job in Italy and I had a lot of time by myself. And I brought my sewing machine. I made like 35 rope bowls for the cast of the crew. I loved it.
This is one of my favorite things I've heard today. Tony Hale's rope bowls. Is there a specific name for this type of art, or is it just called rope bowls?
Just rope bowls. And I haven't really diverted from any different, you know, style or anything. I like the same. I find out someone's color. What's your favorite color, Chris?
Well, I like a blue. I like a lot of the blue family. Yeah. I am very much a Bob Ross fan, and you know,
the
one
Bob
of the
Ross blue.
You know, there's a cheese. There's a cheese company in our area because we live in where there's a lot of farms and stuff that made a Bob Ross cheese.
Yeah,
that was delicious, by the way. I wouldn't paint with it, but it was a delicious cheese. But a Bob Ross blue, Bob Ross's go-to, he loved phthalo blue. phthalo blue is this really gorgeous electric blue. And okay. if you watch a lot of, I watch a lot of Joya painting before I go to sleep at night. It's very, very meditative. Really? Yeah. It's so meditative because his voice just never gets above a,
He's kind of the Ina Garten of painting.
I mean, he really is just so peaceful to watch. So phthalo blue is a good blue that I like, but
how do you spell that? T-H-A-L-O?
It's P-T-H-A-L-O, phthalo blue. And there's also a phthalo green that he uses sometimes. So I like phthalo blue, but one of my all-time favorite colors is whatever color Gonzo is of the Muppets. But I looked it up and he's actually a purple gray. So where I think I would probably land, Tony, is that if I were just like a really simple blue, would be Smurf blue. I think I just like a good Smurf blue. And I'm sure that some nerd has figured out exactly what it is online. Should be pretty easy to find. But I just really have this, if I'm really thinking about it, I think, you know, just finding an old discontinued box of Smurfberry Crunch and eating it out of a Smurf blue colored rope bowl would be really nice.
That's great. Or just watching me get that cereal and mesh it into a powder to get the snack thing. Like, that's how nerd out I get. And I'm like, I'm going to find that Smurf blue.
I think the Smurf berries are like a reddish pink color. I don't think they're, oh. I don't think, don't think you would have to. I mean, Tony, if you mashed up Smurfs to make a Smurf blue, that's your Gargamel. You're basically Gargamel.
By the way, you can't eat out of it. It is a purely a decorative.
Is it dishwasher safe?
It is a decorative piece that you put on your shelf. You can put some keys in it or something like that.
You know what? It's an art piece that can hold something. By the way, this sounds like something that our daughter would love to just like put things. She loves dinosaurs. And so she has all these dinosaurs. She, like, put the dinosaurs in a rope bowl. I mean, so let me just ask you, knowing that you do something specifically for yourself where there's no result other than the process of something that's joyful to you, would you ever take it commercial, or would you be like, I can't because it'll soil the experience and then I'll have to find a new hobby?
Yeah, no, I would never. I just give them as gifts. I would never want to sell it. Sometimes, like, if someone's doing an auction, like a charity thing, I'll say, hey, I'll make it. But like, no, that takes the joy out of it for me.
Of course it does.
You know, because it's so also really fun. Like when I was in doing that job, the whole process of obviously finding the paint and the rope, and I would get the rope at Walmart and I would ship it over, and then I would bring it in my suitcase, and I would bring the, and then I would, you know, on the day, like, okay, I got to find bags to put them in. So I pass them out, and then I got to find a ribbon to tie. And it's all that kind of process. The giving of it is really fun. Cause I will say, if there was ever a talent that if I could magically have, it would be painting. When I see like realistic painting, realism, I'm just absolutely blown away with it.
I know. How do they get the edges?
I don't even get it. And it's, the thought of like painting something for someone is just so awesome. And so this is the closest I feel like I can do, you know?
Obviously there's, just like anything else, maybe there's natural born talent. Maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's Maybelline. Maybe it's just a little bit of work, you know? Yeah. Like, it's what I've learned with trying to learn musical instruments in deep middle age is that it takes a little, some of the romance out of it. But it is a lot of muscle memory and practice. Yeah. And so if you did, I guarantee you there are courses you could take online that could probably get you so much closer to realistic painting than you ever imagined. Mm. But, you know, it's just hours spent. How much time do you want to devote to that?
That's a really good point. Because, like, actually today I was driving in my car and I saw this woman sitting by her stoop very simply. And I had that thought of like, oh, if I could paint, like, I would love to paint that image.
Ma'am, could you sit here for 19 hours?
Exactly. You don't know me, but I got some snacks and some
Tony water. Hale.
Yeah. No, she would not even. Most of them, no. That would never happen. Sorry, I just got distracted. My daughter is landing, and I'm
of course.
I'm making sure she got her.
Of course you are. And how kind of her to let you know that she's landed.
And I just hope she got her connection. Well, okay. All right.
Is she landing on the first leg of the flight?
This is like her, one of her layovers. Is it IMPA? Anyways, I'll check in that in a minute.
You know what? I love, listen, that is, speaking of landing, that's a perfect place to land this podcast, because we started kind of talking about that, and then the synchrony of the universe has brought us to this moment of still.
What if, like, I made up the whole thing that I had a daughter and she came out? Well,
that would be
just to give you a good button.
That would, I know. Someone's going to call me and go, you know, Tony is not. He's not married. He doesn't have a kid. He lives in Alabama, but he doesn't.
My. Well, thanks for having me, brother.
Listen, there are people that I always get excited to see at events in Los Angeles, because there are people to me that sort of feel like home base, people that I feel comfortable seeing, that I know I can have, like, a substance.
Yeah,
worthy conversation, but also just kind of silly and make dumb jokes too. And I legitimately always enjoy running into you, because I still don't entirely feel comfortable at, like, events after 30 years. And so I'm just being very full disclosure, like, why I always gravitate toward you when I see you. And I think, like, oh my God, Tony, because it just, you make me feel better to be there.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. There are people like you too, that there's a bump of joy when you see them, where it's like, oh, Hardwick.
It's going to be okay. We're going to be okay.
It's comfort. You know, you feel seen, and then you kind of, you know, talk to the next person where you don't feel seen.
You're like, where'd Tony go? Oh, he's over by the thing. I'm just going to go track him down. Hey, Tony, how long do we have to stay here?
So true.
I really appreciate it. I genuinely have kind of, I'd sort of moved away a little bit from doing the Zoomy podcast, just because being in person, I just missed being in person for so many years during the pandemic. But obviously you're in Alabama and I'm in California, and this was every bit as good as being in person. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Same, man. Thank you for talking about all this stuff. It's just a great reminder. You know, that's what we do. We just keep talking about it.
And I think it's helpful for people, you know, especially for people who look up to you, or people who go, oh my God, Tony is a guy I respect. And if he is, you know, still has these questions and things, and maybe I'm not so weird, and maybe it's okay, and maybe I'll be okay. It's like it really helps normalize it for people, because it really does help them feel seen and helps them feel like not like an anomaly, like, oh, we all kind of go through this and it's okay and we'll be okay.
It is. And or there's other people that listen to me and go, well, at least I'm not that.
That's the Jerry Springer effect. Oh, like, I'm going to watch this show because at least I'm not being dragged off a stage by a bouncer stagehand.
I didn't have to give a paternity test in non-national television.
And now my final thought.
Man, amazing. Be good to yourself. Give yourself grace. You're an amazing dad, amazing friend, funny, kind.
That's back at you, man. I really appreciate you. And I, not to put too much pressure on the situation, because I don't want it to feel like a chore, but I would really like to see a Tony Hill rope bowl, maybe in a Smurf blue, if it's not too much trouble to match that color.
Oh, I'm matching that. All right. I'm going to go check and make sure my daughter landed so I can call
her. Okay, please do. Tony, it's good to see you.
All right, see you. I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later. Bye.
You thought the podcast was over. Well, it might be if you don't want to hear this last thing that I'm tacking on here. So in the body of the podcast, I mentioned that my wife and I have watched so many times this show called Unicorn Academy, because our three-year-old is obsessed with it. And we have watched every episode with her so many times. She knows all the unicorns. We got her unicorn toys from the show. There's a bunch of songs in the show. She calls them out by name when we're driving. But the song that she requests the most, of course, would probably be the theme song, which she calls Follow Your Heart. She goes, Follow Your Heart. Dad, Follow Your Heart. So it will just be in the car, and we'll just play it on a loop And she just loves to hear it over and over and over and over again. And we've heard this song so many times that it's basically just been branded onto our brains. It's a fine song. It's just a very, like, it's a straight up, like, it's what you would think. It's a pop song for a unicorn themed show that we have heard 95,000 times, minimum. But it's so sweet and charming because she loves it so much. My wife and I, we just have started, we're just sort of used to hearing it now. And so I thought, well, I have to, what's the most opposite version of this song that I could make just for fun? And I was like, oh, well, it's got to be like, you know, because the original song is so like bright and cheery and uplifting. So it's got to be like, you know, like late 90s indie rock, you know, maybe a little Elliott Smith, just, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, just kind of melancholy indie pop would be the most opposite version of this song that I could think of. So I called my friend PB, who is at Opus Orange on Instagram. I make a lot of silly, fun songs with him. And again, you know, part of why I'm posting this and talking for several more minutes is because I'm an overthinker and an overtalker, but also, you know, I've made like two dozen songs, and but they were never meant to. I never really intended to release them, and sort of the fun part about that was that I just made them for me. I made them to learn. You know, my friend PB is a master musician and producer, knows so much about music theory. And so a lot of making the songs was just like, oh, I'm not really making them for anyone. They're just for me. I want to learn more about music. I want to learn more about music production. And I want to, you know, just if there are places that I can play on stuff, instruments, I would like to do that too. So it's been like a masterclass these last few years, just making songs that I never really intended to release. But now that I have a podcast, I'm like, well, I don't know, maybe I should just throw some of these out there. I mean, they're all silly and dumb. The song that I'm about to post, yes, it is intentionally silly. So it's important to note that all the songs are just like, I don't know how to write serious songs. They're just all like dumb comedy songs, you know, like, half-written bits turned into songs, or just really random non sequitur silly things, or, oh, I wonder what this would sound like in the style of this, you know, like they're comedy songs. I'm not saying they're all like ha-ha hilarious, but they're like quirky, you know, like just sort of they're silly and fun. And so, you know, I'm posting this because I questioned it. I went back and forth, like, I don't know. It's like, no one's going to care. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know that I'm really that great at what I do with music. You know, PB is an incredible producer, but, you know, like, I don't know if these are what someone would consider good or not. But, you know, as I was having this conversation with myself, I said to Lydia, like, should I post the song? I just don't, who's going to care? You know, she was like, you have to stop. You have got to just post it. Just post it. And I was like, oh my God. Now I have to, because it would be incongruous for me to host a podcast about overthinking to try to encourage people to just go around the chatter in their heads to just make the things that they want to make and just put them out in the world if they want to. So, you know, look, a lot of people probably tuned out like minutes ago. But if you stayed this long, thank you. And I'm just going to post a song, like it or don't, listen to it or don't. It's all good as far as I'm concerned. I'm just putting it out there because I made it and I might as well. You know, I have a Spotify page that I've never really used. I think there's just stand up on there. Maybe I'll figure out how to post songs on there. I have no idea. But what might make more sense to you is if you go either before or after you listen to this, if you're still listening to this, is just go find the Unicorn Academy theme, just so that you can see how it started and how it's going. So here it is, my 90s indie rock cover of the Unicorn Academy theme. And by the way, I am not talking down about or making fun of the show or the song or whatever. It just, It just was a silly, weird idea that I had. So here it is. And if you're like, hey, Chris Hardwick, I am also someone who is trying a new thing and making stuff and maybe thinking about whether or not to put it out in the world and need a little encouragement. And I'm also a bit nervous and I don't know what to do about it. Just close your eyes and follow your heart.
Follow your heart straight to the stars. Your bond already shows the magic glows. Our friendship grows. Be yourself, nothing to hide. Take a chance and you'll find adventures waiting for you to take. Let's go. Chase your dreams, run wild and free. Trust in your destiny. Follow your heart straight to the stars. Your bond already shows the magic glows. Our friendship grows. So follow your heart. Chase your dreams, run wild and free. Trust in your destiny. Follow your heart straight to the stars. Your bond already shows the magic glows. Our friendship grows. So follow your heart straight to the stars. Your bond already shows the magic glows. Our friendship grows. So follow your heart straight to the stars. Your bond already shows the magic glows. Our friendship grows. So follow your heart.